general government together. I was asked if I would donate an hour of my committee's time to Senator Metzger's committee that was doing a hearing on Portland General Electric. And so we did that, and that's why it's taken us time to get in here. We're late, but we're going to try and get some stuff done real quick and get out of here. If you arrived early, my apologies. If you got lost in the traffic jam, I guess they had an absolutely electrifying time in here.
That's shocking.
It is shocking, wouldn't you say, Senator George? Actually, Senator George, I have to tell you, I don't think they accomplished anything in those hearings. I think the whole thing was wired from the beginning. You know? Anybody else got some puns on PGE this afternoon? We'll see if we can't generate a little more humor here. How's that?
All I know, Mr. Chair, is after 3 hours of that, I need a piece of chocolate, and I see some in front of your station. And
and it's in mint condition, I might say. Anything else, folks?
Okay. We're in trouble this afternoon.
I'm doing this in honor of Johnny Carson. What can I say?
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Okay, with that, we have started, and we're going to open a hearing on Senate Bill, a public hearing on Senate Bill 157, and Judith is going to give us a little bit of background, and then we're going to have Kathy come forward, I think, right?
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 157 redefines the term public official for those subject to investigation by the Secretary of State's Audit Division for loss of public funds or property. It establishes a $100 threshold of loss for mandatory reporting by an agency to the Secretary of State, and it directs that the Division of Audits will determine within 30 days whether or not to conduct an investigation. I will point out there's no revenue impact on this measure. You do have already a fiscal statement issued, and that was in the materials that you had at your seat at the dais. The fiscal impact is indeterminate based on the fact that an investigation can be resolved from with anything from a phone call to a full-blown investigation with the police, Department of Justice, and the district attorney's office. As an example, fiscal gave us that a recent complex investigation did cost $73,000. I will point out that given that the expenses are reimbursed to the audits division either by, let's see, they're recovered either through the agency's biennial audit assessment, or if it's a trust fund agency, it is a billed rate to them. And the other thing that the fiscal statement says is that there's no fiscal impact to the Department of Administrative Services. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One person has signed up, and that's Kathy Plino from the Secretary of State Audits Division. Welcome. It's good to see you. Glad you're here. By the way, if anybody else is signing up on any of the bills today, be sure to sign up early and often. Go ahead, Kathy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, I'm Kathy Polino. I'm with the Secretary of State Audits Division. I'd like to give you just a little bit of brief background. Currently, state statutes require us to, requires agencies to report in writing to the Secretary of State's office when they sustain a loss of public funds or property, and it gives us the responsibility to investigate those losses. But the way that the statutes are currently written, there currently is some confusion between us and state agencies as to who this applies to, what should be reported, and what timelines actions need to take place. So there's really four main things that these changes will do to those statutes, and I appreciate the lead-in because most of these were covered, so I appreciate that. But the first thing it does is it more clearly defines who the statute applies to. The change clarifies that the statute applies to all public officials, which are defined as any person who is serving a state agency as an officer, employee, member, agent, or otherwise, regardless of whether the person is compensated for their services. Currently, the law states that it applies to any elected or appointed state officer, including members of boards and commissions, and so some agencies aren't sure if a public official includes their state employees, and we want to clarify that, yes, if a state employee does steal money or property from the state, that should be reported to us also. So hopefully that will help clear some of that up. Second thing that it does is it establishes a dollar threshold. The change would say that if they sustain a loss of $100 or more, they should report that to us. Currently, there's no threshold in the law, and so agencies, kind of in absence of having a threshold, have made made some decisions on their own as to what they should and shouldn't report. And so with the dollar figure there, we figure we can give them a little bit of direction as to what gets reported.
On average, what threshold have they been establishing?
Mr. Chair, it varies, and we actually had some that were started reporting every little ream of paper that they couldn't account for, to some feel that $5,000-$10,000, if they handle it themselves as a personnel matter, shouldn't be reported. And so we want to at least put a dollar figure, we want it to be high enough so we don't get those reams of paper reported, but not too high, because usually when that first occurrence comes up, it's many times just the tip of the iceberg and they're not really sure what the actual loss is. So we do want it to be low enough so that those things do get reported to us. Or if we see multiple occurrences at an agency, little bits and pieces, we can pull that together and hopefully take it.
I want to give you a chance to finish, but I already have a bunch of questions. So
go right ahead.
Are you done? I mean, I'll let you make two more points then.
Two more things that the statute does. It establishes a timeline for reporting. Currently, the statutes don't have a length of time when the agency discovers the loss to when they need to report to us. So what we put in the statute is, or the proposed legislation is, a 30-day reporting. We'd actually like it sooner than that. But some agencies feel that, they're going to do their own internal investigation and handle it. And then by the time it gets reported to us, it's way too late. And then the fourth thing it does is it changes the requirement. Right now, the statutes require us to complete our investigation in 30 days. And when we get involved with the police and other matters, sometimes it stretches out beyond that. And so we would like to change it so that we determine whether to initiate an investigation within that 30-day period, as opposed to being completed by that time. And so, Mr. Chair, I'll take your questions now.
Well, the first one was, when I looked at the $100, I was saying, will there be times when the cost to investigate something may be 10 times the cost of the infraction or recovering or whatever? How do you make those kind of decisions?
Mr. Chair, there's a lot of judgment that does go into it, and I would say that sometimes there is cases when it will cost more to investigate than what the actual loss is, but we feel that there's also a deterrent effect that comes, if let's say an employee steals $5,000 and it takes us $10,000 worth of our time to prosecute and investigate, the message that somebody is looking is an important message that goes out. We are out right now asking questions. We're doing something that's called data mining, where we are looking at credit card purchases that state agencies make. And, we're seeing lots of things that are popping up on this list.
Any airplanes lately? Never mind.
No, but those little things that we're seeing, we can make a phone call that might take a little bit of our time, but when we ask multiple times for people to justify their purchases, we think there is a deterrent effect that takes place. The other important piece of what we do is we not only look at that individual case, but we look at the controls over the agency to prevent it from happening again. And a good example is, out at Economic Development, they had an employee that over a 10-year period stole over $200,000. We went in, did a brief review of what they were doing, but we looked at their control over all their cash accounts and not just that one that was stolen from. And so they were able to take those and apply it to all the different accounts that they had and improve their controls.
If one person's stealing $200,000, is it possible you discovered some others in the same process?
It could happen. It didn't happen that time,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. The second question I have, I know what we're doing with budget cuts these days and what staffing is like. How are you staffing for this? I mean, what effects is this going to have on your staffing?
Mr. Chair, we are currently doing as many investigations as we can with the current staff we have. And the work is really sporadic, and when it comes in, we do triage it with the other audit work that we have. You know, we have busy seasons and lighter seasons, so we try to pick up the work in the off season. We do have an option package in our budget this session for 6 additional investigators that would augment this function. You know, we're doing our best we can with what we have, which is anywhere from 3 or 4 people at any given time working on things. But there's a lot. When we started doing this data mining, there is just a plate full of things that need to be followed up on, and it's just waiting there ready for us. So.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator George.
Kathy, we're talking about the deterrent factor, and I want you to know that the reason I've had that recorder for such a long time is because we didn't have the headphones at first. But I will get it back for tomorrow, I guarantee you.
See, this.
You get confessions?
Any other confessions? Senator Berger, did you have your hand up?
I did. I had a question. My question is, when you audit, if you find something as serious as $200,000, is there any way that you also give some advice as to how their process was working that could leave the door open for an employee? In other words, it's kind of the thing of 2 signatures on a check, the person bringing in the money never is the person that counts it and deposits it. That those kind of just common sense things, do you find that those practices that we have in business every day are not being used by the agencies?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berger, that's a great question because there are a lot of different parties involved when there is a loss of funds, and they all have a slightly different point role on it. Like the state police, you know, they are looking at gathering evidence against that individual so that they can prosecute the individual. Our role is to take a look at that occurrence and to see what breakdowns took place that allowed it to happen, mm-hmm. and to make those recommendations to improve it. And then we also have a kind of a second role is to make sure, because, you know, our job is to ensure fiscal accountability. We want to make sure state funds are used for the right purposes. So we're not, you know, we are concerned about getting that one individual, but we want to make sure that the entire loss is identified, right. Not just enough to prosecute. So
absolutely.
That's kind of our 2 roles, is to get our arms around the full amount of the loss, and then the second is to look at how it occurred and to make recommendations to improve that. So that's what you'll see in our audit reports when we do these investigations, is recommendations to tighten up controls. And then kind of on a third, as we do some training, you know, we've learned over time how these things happen, and we take it from not just that one agency, but we also teach other agencies kind of proactively. We get training to them on how to prevent it. They all are interested in not being in the headlines of the newspapers like their friends, so they listen.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just make a comment. I thank you for that reply, and I appreciate what you've said, because obviously you're in a position to really assist. And if you see a pattern, that pattern needs to be broken. So the deterrent can be done by the change of the process.
Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Senator Warren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to a comment to Senator Verger, the audit reports are quite fascinating to read. And Ms. Polino is correct. They list the problem that's wrong and then a recommendation. And I've been poring over the audit reports as chair of the Education Committee, looking at both the Department of Education, the Oregon University System, and anything else I can get my hands on so I can familiarize myself with their budgets and things that they're doing wrong or not doing right. And you know, the purpose of the audit report is also to advise them what they could do better. It's not so much to penalize them, but to tell them how they could do their controls better. But the question I have for you, Ms. Polino, is that I read in here that you want to remove the 30 days that the investigation is to be complete by, but you leave it rather open-ended. Not rather, you do. I mean, it's not closed-ended at all. I don't mind you taking off the 30 days, but how long is a person supposed to expect that it's going to take to complete it? I mean, can you do, like, you know, 60 days or 90 days or have a status report at some point? But really, someone who's being investigated needs to know when the closure is going to be there.
Right. And, Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's one of the most difficult things is once these investigations get to a certain point, they really kind of get out of our hands. Once they get tied up into legal, we can't even discuss or issue our audit reports until the legal process goes through all its channels. And so that's why it kind of gets difficult. We'll gather our evidence and we'll hand it over to the district attorneys. And then they'll take it from there and prosecute their case. But we can't then issue our report while it's still tied up in the legal courts. And so, I'd hate to commit to any kind of timelines when it really leaves our hands after a certain point.
And Mr. Chair, yes. A current example would be the Baker Union ESD that is being investigated for using their funds for purposes other than what was expected. And I understand there's some law enforcement agencies involved in that investigation. So for you to complete your audit, you have to wait until that's done. And okay, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You bought my vote. Well, not literally. Please, out there in TV land.
I got him. They keep telling us over and over in this chair training.
Yeah. Right. You have my vote. Let's put it that way.
They keep telling us in this chair training stuff, but watch what you say when the microphones are on. And I suppose her comments recently about just now about the ESD go back to my wisecrack about the airplane and how somebody could purchase one of those and think they could do that in a state that has so little money. I don't have any further questions. I would like to say that I like the bill, and we will bring it back in a week or so. We are hoping to fly through several bills this afternoon. We don't have as much time as we would have had, but thank you for coming. And if there's anybody else that wants to comment on this, now's the time. If I don't hear, okay, we're going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 157 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 90. Judith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 90 does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I'll point that out first. The measure abolishes the Capital Planning Commission. It transfers those duties to DAS. It eliminates the Capital Planning Commission accounts and transfers money in the accounts to the Department of Administrative Services Operating Fund. This measure does declare an emergency and wouldn't be effective June 30th, 2005. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm resisting a lot. No, I'm not. I'm not going to resist at all.
Go for it.
It transfers it to DAS, and I slipped over to Senator Walker and said, would that make it a dastardly deed? I'm sorry. It's a late afternoon hearing. I try to keep people here awake. What can I say? All right. Is there anybody signed up to speak on this? Is there anybody signed up? Yeah, get me. Yeah. See, we got people here that want to talk, and I don't even know who they are yet. So, you know, it takes a while for us to get in the groove, you know. Somebody's got to make the rationale. I got two no's. Anybody want to make the yes? Well, Mitch, come on up and tell us why we shouldn't do it. And Bill, you might as well join him. Wait a minute. He is from DAS. Somebody's going to have to explain this to me.
Did I check the wrong box?
I think you checked the wrong box. Are you a yes?
Yes.
The column beside the yes is no. So I move you to the left. Do you want to be moved to the left?
Yes.
You're a yes. Okay. We'll let the yes go first, and then we'll follow with the City of Salem saying no. Is that fair?
Mr. Chair, I want to point out that I think we're neutral on this.
Oh, you're neutral. Well, you also marked no. Oh.
No.
Okay.
Oops. Okay.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Foster. I'm the acting administrator of the Facilities Division of Department of Administrative Services. Wanted to just start out by giving you just a little background about what's behind the measure. During the 2003 session, the Capital Planning Commission was suspended for the 03-05 biennium. A budget note directed the Facilities Division to fully implement the public review process for the Capital Projects Advisory Board, And the governor's budget currently contains no funding for the commission. And what will result from no action is the commission being reestablished without staff or budget. What DAS has done to date is implemented the budget note as we were directed. Since there's no action is really not a viable choice, there's really three options. One is to reestablish funding for the agency. The second is to extend the suspension for 0507. And the third is to abolish the commission. And the Department of Administrative Services recommends abolishing the commission and has provided that vehicle through Senate Bill 90. And Senate Bill 90 will permanently put in place the temporary measures that were established for 0305. Basically, it abolishes the commission but retains the basic definitions of the capital area and other related provisions in statute. It transfers the primary duty for maintaining plans for state properties in the Salem-Keizer area to DAS and the property-owning agencies. And it adds an additional requirement for an overall coordination plan for the Salem-Keizer area.
Any questions? Mitch, you're here from the city of Salem, is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Just state your name for the record, if you would. And,
Chair Shields, members of the committee, my name is Mitch Rose, and I'm the Interim Urban Planning Administrator for the City of Salem. And I'm going to go home and tell my wife this evening that I've met someone who tells more puns and worse puns than I do.
During your testimony, spare us the punishment.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, the room was charged with energy, yeah. But currently we need to spark. Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm not here to oppose the bill today. The City of Salem regrets the demise of the Capital Planning Commission, but we're not here to try to resurrect that. Rather, we wanted to get on the record as being very interested in two main things. One is we want to remain in the loop. We want to be informed. We want DAS to coordinate closely with us whenever there is going to be some kind of a change in the land use in the capital area. And as we looked at the bill, we discovered a couple of paragraphs in there that caused us a little bit of a question, if not an outright concern. And the other thing that we really want, of course, is to ensure that what happens in terms of the land use that is done by the state, development that is done by the state in the capital city, is consistent with our planning and zoning. And so, if I could call your attention to, I just have this one-page handout here, which basically reproduces Section 12 of the bill. If you'll go down to the bottom of that page, you'll see the next to the last paragraph in italics is to be deleted. And then the other paragraph in bold at the bottom would be added by this bill. We were a little nervous about that because it looks to us as if you're taking away something that calls for coordination and, in fact, a plan amendment through the City of Salem if there is going to be a big change, and you're replacing that with something that just says, well, DAS will inform you if they're going to do anything. I have since talked with Mr. Foss, and I've received his assurances that that's not the intent of the bill, and we're comfortable with those assurances. But I want to be on the record as saying that we very much want to remain in the loop. We very much want to retain the existing authority over land use that we have.
I too have some of those concerns. You and Bill might get along just fine. And DAS might keep you in the loop, and they might consult with you, but someday you'll retire, and there'll be somebody else, and you'll be gone, and there'll be somebody else. What is there in the bill that ensures that there'll be a continued ongoing consultation so that the state of Oregon doesn't end up just kind of ignoring the city of Salem's comprehensive plan and so on and so forth. I think that rather than just having those assurances, Mitch, you could suggest to us a little bit of an amendment here that actually gets some of the wording that you want back in the bill. Am I out to lunch on this?
I agree.
Well, my good vice chair agrees with me. I appreciate that, Senator George. Bill, do you have a comment?
Mr. Chairman, I think we took sort of a minimalist approach toward dealing with this, and a certain amount of the...
You might be the first people in government to ever take a minimalist approach.
And,
go ahead.
And a certain amount of the things that you're perhaps talking about, we have addressed by administrative rule in this interim. Now, it may be more appropriate to put a few of those items into the statute rather than simply in the rule, or, and maybe both, acknowledge that rules will be developed.
I don't want to dominate this. Anybody here that wants to comment, please jump in. But it seems to me this won't be the first example of taking something that's in rule and putting it in statute in this legislative session.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, administrative rules can come and go all too easily. And there, it seems to me that some of number one, I haven't seen what you've got in administrative rule. The relevant part maybe should be brought to us. We should see it. And you guys should be involved, and maybe we should decide to take sections of it and put it in statute along with this bill, as part of this bill. Do you guys have a problem with where I'm going?
Well, Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
I don't like the bill at all. Just because I don't think we should get rid of the Capital Planning Commission. I mean, it's kind of a draconian measure to just defund it, and so you defund it so then you get rid of it. But I don't really see any choice.
I agree with you. In an ideal world, I would have never done away with the Planning Commission itself. I think it served a good purpose. But we made a decision 2 years ago. I wasn't really a big part of that decision to defund it. So now you've got this empty shell, and if you can't afford it, I mean, the other option has been suggested, and that's to sunset it, or to extend the sunset a couple years. That doesn't really address the question. Can we get to a result that's fair to the city of Salem, that keeps DAS accountable when present personnel and present understandings are gone from the scene, and when rule might be changed?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that delayed our concerns to some extent is there's right now, as a sort of a interim substitute, if you will, for the Capital Planning Commission, there's an advisory committee to DAS, which does include the City of Salem's Community Development Director and the Assistant Director, I believe it is, from the Public Works Department. And I don't know how many other people are on that committee. Mr. Foster can tell us that. And that's the type of arrangement that we would like to continue and perpetuate, either under administrative rule or statute, preferably statute, so that we continue to have a hand in the decision.
I would think so. Are there questions that any of you would have? Yes. Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr.
Who's got some background in this.
Well, I just am curious about, has there been a problem up until now? You had the Planning Commission, were they that active? I mean, obviously, you've had projects that have been done around the Capitol in years, and the City of Salem has been involved. I'm trying to get my arms around just where you've been as much as where you're going to go after this.
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger.
In your answering the question, and I appreciate your question, Senator Verger, we're asking for a little history lesson here.
Mm-hmm.
And my knowledge of that history could be inaccurate, but there were some real things that led to a Capital Planning Commission way back, where some of the consultation that you would have expected down in Coos Bay didn't occur here in Salem. You follow what I'm driving at? Go ahead. I'd like to hear some of
Mr. Chair, I think that's exactly right. I have to say that I'm relying purely on anecdotal evidence and historical memory, the same as you are. I started with the city of Salem on November 1st, so my institutional memory is pretty short. Yeah, I started just 3 months ago, so my institutional memory is pretty short, but maybe Mr. Foster, I'm not sure how long you've been associated with DAS, but...
Spent more than 20 years working with Capital Planning.
You want to fill us in, either of you, on the history?
Mr. Chairman, I think, you know, the commission has a long history, and it really was kind of created around the time after the Capitol was reconstructed, and the legislature redefined the Capitol Mall. And it's one of the funny little nuances. That's why it spells O-L instead of A-L, because it related to the building, and that's the official name. But there, I think over time, there's been a lot of issues and controversy, particularly as the extension of the Capitol Mall went out into the neighborhood in the areas that were defined by that statute change. But in reality, I think many of those issues have been worked through. The most sensitive boundary conditions up there around D Street are now being brought to a conclusion. You know, the archives building is sitting on one of the blocks. We've relocated and rehabbed some houses that have become a bridge to the neighborhood. So I think at a certain level, there is less need today than there once was. That's not to say that there certainly aren't ongoing issues and the need for very definite working relationships with the city of Salem. But I think, you know, what we're trying to do, and I think your point about maybe making sure that some of this is well institutionalized is well taken, but we really are trying to work in good partnership with the city, and an example is the work with the Mill Creek potential industrial development that was passed by the city council last night, and there's you know, a long and very close working relationship and partnership between the state and the city on that. And I think that's probably more where this is kind of going, and that effort really is being led by DAS and would not have been something under the purview of the Capital Planning Commission anyway.
Mr. Chair, I would echo what he said about the cooperation between DAS and the City of Salem on the Mill Creek project. There's been a very good working relationship on that over the past year, or two, or three. Having said that, I do have to note that I believe that there will continue to be in the future some land use conflicts whenever an institution as large as state government in the capital city decides to do something in the way of a large development. That's just inevitable, and what we want is basically a system in place where there is some way for the city to sit down at the table with DAS and other interested parties and represent the city's very real interests in the kind of development that would occur not only here but elsewhere in the city if a large state facility was going to be built.
There is a problem when we rely on short memory and anecdotal information. Mm-hmm. I remember a comment that was made to me, and this may be totally wrong, but there was a comment that I heard that came from a legislator that way back in 5 when this building burned and rebuilt in 39, but one of the options that was considered that they were just going to move across the street and build over at Willamette. I mean, you know, that's kind of an extreme example, but it's kind of an example of how the state can sometimes be a rather arrogant big brother to the city. And in as much as that can happen if we forget our history and if we don't have things in place, I would like to see more than rule. I'd like to see pieces of it amended into the statute to give you a little more comfort.
We would.
And so that we can, in fact, be sure that we don't again become that arrogant big brother. Am I Senator George and then Senator Bridger.
I totally agree. When we were working on the financing for the improvements out at the state fair, you know, last time, one of the things, and it might have just been my perception, but I don't think so, was that there was some distrust on the part of the city towards what we were going to do, and it took the administration, you know, at the fair, to be able to establish that they were in fact going to act as a good partner, you know, as a local partner, in order to establish the basis to go ahead and move forward. I've learned over the years, spell out in advance. It's worked for 40 years in marriage, what the obligations and expectations are, and it works very good in business to do the same thing. If you expect to have openness and consultation and cooperation, that's what you'll get. If someone thinks they have an upper hand, normally human nature being what it is, they will do that. So I'm with you. I think it would be good to put that in there that they will.
Okay.
In fact, I think that's a little weak language there. I would like to
make it a little stronger. Here's the senator. Senator Virgin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like for you to go to Section 18. I have a couple of questions. One is when they're talking about transferring the funds from the Capital Planning Commission to DAS, what kind of money are we talking about?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Virger, in this particular case, there's a special additional responsibility that the Capital Planning Commission had with respect to some oversight relative to the executive residence. And that section is talking about the executive residence account.
Right. But in an earlier section over here, where it talks about the funds being transferred, there is a transfer, section 3.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Virger, the difference here is those are some small amount of residual operating funds that the commission had, and I think it was under $20,000 that was left. And this is sort of some standard language that the Legislative Council uses when they're abolishing an agency. The executive residence account has a little more money in it, and it's basically some donated funds that came for the benefit of different improvements at the governor's residence. And so that's just a custodial spot for those funds to sit until some project is earmarked for their use.
Follow up, please.
Yes.
Yes, I just want to clearly understand, when the commission is no longer in existence, there will not be a continuation of money going into the DAS account because they have taken over these, assume these duties.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Virger, there had been an assessment that was charged to state agencies for this, and when the commission was abolished, so was that assessment. So, no, there is no further flow of funds to the Department of Administrative Services. And while we are at least wanting to leave the door open for a future discussion of whether some piece of an FTE may be necessary, at this point in time, we're saying we can absorb it with no cost.
At no cost.
Yes.
And the follow-up fee?
Yes.
The executive residence account was just a separate matter, but I notice in Section 18 it shows some, is that new language that's in bold?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Virger, truthfully, the way this was suspended and then resurrected and the changes are really hard to follow. And I do not believe that this is new language. I think it's just resurrecting something that had been there. But the mechanics of doing that were rather interesting.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there other questions? What I would really like to do is to ask you two gentlemen, if you would, to work out an amendment that you think is fair, then get that language to Judith so that we can have a work session, because I think there's interest in working this out, but I want more guarantees for the city of Salem. Anything that looks, acts, or sounds like an arrogant big brother to be gone, banished. Is that okay with all you folks?
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd be very pleased to do that, and I appreciate the opportunity to do that. We discovered the deal, I discovered the deal yesterday at 4 o'clock, so this will give me an opportunity to flesh out my concerns a little bit.
And Judith is very accessible, so we can deal with it. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 90, and I'm going to open, if only for a few minutes, the hearing on Senate Bill 80. So I'll let you guys step back real quick. There's the thing that I want to do is that there's one person particularly that lives more than 100 miles that's actually come to testify. And that's Eileen. Is that one of the two of you?
It's been a long day. My math was a little bit off. Sorry.
Regardless.
Huh? Round trip.
Okay, well, you've come a ways. And are you Susanna?
I am Susanna Knight. I'm the administrator for the State Board of Geologist Examiners. The office is here in Salem.
I'll let you go first then.
Okay. I want to note that Eileen brought along her son so that she could come today, because I said, Eileen, it's more valuable for you to be here than it is for me. So I'm going to defer to Eileen and be support for her if she needs any.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Eileen Webb. I am a registered professional geologist. I work for AMEC Earth and Environmental in Portland, and I now serve as the vice chair of the Board of Geologist Examiners. And the reason why we're here today is we need to do a little housekeeping and cleanup on our rule. There's kind of a hole as we see it right now that allows some applicants to become registered even though they do not have the required education. Basically, the way the rule stands right now, if someone has a bachelor degree of arts in geology, they don't have the required coursework. So what this allows us to do is to put into rule the authority to set up some kind of basic standards for coursework toward the degree in geology.
Okay.
And I would request that we enter this introductory letter into the record.
Okay.
In support.
Are there any questions that the committee has about the rationale for this little bit of, what did you call it?
Housekeeping.
Housekeeping work that you would like to be done? I don't think there'll be any problem with this. Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eileen, it looks like you are making it easier and broader for more people to be certified rather than raising the standards. Have I read this wrong?
If, I'm sorry, thank you. If that's how you interpret it, it's not how we intended. I think what we're trying to do is to, if someone comes to us requesting registration that has a Bachelor of Arts degree, we just want to make sure that their coursework is sufficient. To get a Bachelor of Arts in geology, we've found applicants coming to us with only half the amount of coursework that someone that has a Bachelor of Science degree in geology. So they're not as qualified to protect the public in this state, and that's what we're looking for.
Okay, follow-up, please.
Yes.
It says that it removes the requirement that a person have a degree in order to register as a geologist in training.
Thank you. I can explain that, too. During some recent board discussions and decisions, we decided that there are a number of people that are qualified to do the work based on the amount of coursework they've taken. Maybe they have a degree in geology, or I'm sorry, a degree in geography, or a somewhat related field but they have the experience, the qualifications, the education, and background that we feel that we should allow them registration. What we're trying to do is, even for those folks, to set a standard for the coursework, not necessarily for the degree. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Chair Shields, if I might interject, Senator Berger, we have three categories of licensing. The registered geologist is preceded by a geologist in training, which is a GIT. The way the statute is currently written, you cannot become a GIT unless you have the degree in geology. However, the way the statute is written, you can become a registered geologist after you meet the experience if you have a minimum of 45 hours in geology. What this will allow is if you were a major in geography, but you had 45, or you didn't even have a degree, but you have 45 hours in geology, of which 36 are upper division, you would be eligible to take the first half of the national exam and become a GIT. Right now, you can't do that unless you have the degree. So that's the little bit of adjustment that's being made, too.
Yes, thank you very much. That does clarify it for me.
Okay.
The one thing that you have to realize, you're becoming extremely popular. Everybody wants to know about the geology of the formations of Oregon and the tsunamis and the earthquakes. And so when you see geologists, you're really taking center stage this day and time.
Unfortunately, that isn't the way it is on the national level. In the last year, I had a phone call from a registered geologist who works in the national legislature advising Congress on issues of science, and in particular geology. And the way that the coursework is moving, the number of geology students has been dropping. And there's concern on the highest level as to what's happening with the practice and what's going on here. And the movement seems to be toward environmental science more, and you'll hear that word thrown around a lot. And I've been working in this position for 6 years now, and many of our compliance cases have been environmental science people doing geology without the knowledge that they're even doing geology. So what we're hoping to accomplish here by looking at coursework is that maybe some of those environmental science people do have the right curriculum, or with a few more courses could meet a curriculum standard and be able to become registered to practice as a geologist. So that's also a possibility.
Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'd just like to make a comment. I think you need to protect your profession. I think you need to have the highest standards. There is a lot that depends on the information that you give us. You're familiar with Dogami, I'm sure. And I can tell you that there are some of us on the coast that have lived and died by what Dogami has told us. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate any protection that you have in the qualifications of those people that would be giving us information.
Thank you, Senator Berger. I wanted to add, too, that one of our board members is the state geologist, Vicki McConnell of Dogami.
Yes.
And I do she know. Meant to be here today, but couldn't make it.
Are there any other questions? I know that a couple of our committee members, I guess if there's no other questions, I'm going to close this hearing and let you step back. We will back to this and deal with it in a work session in a week or so.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. I wanted to kind of ask the committee what they want to do. Had I been given a full hour, we'd be done within the hour. But we really couldn't start until about 4:15. You want to hold over Senate Bill 67? You guys are the ones that have been sitting here since 1 o'clock.
Mr. Chair, I have an appointment and need to leave the building by about 5:40, and I'd really like to get back to my office and refreshments.
I don't think... Go ahead.
No.
Were you going to suggest something? I don't think that it would be too hard on the director of Oregon Parks and Rec to come back, would it? Okay. With that, I'm going to adjourn today's hearing right on time, and we'll have you back here soon. Okay?
Thank you.
With that, you're adjourned.